Destruction. A 17-year-old Islamic Jihad activist blows himself up outside of a crowded bar in Tel Aviv, killing at least 9 civilians, wounding 50 others. The world is set bracing, thinking the United States is going to attack Iran. What will happen next? In a moment, Peter Lance is our guest with a sort of a twist to everything that's going on this planet. He kind of puts it in perspective in his book, Cover Up. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Peter Lance is a 5-time Emmy Award-winning investigative reporter, now working as a screenwriter and a novelist. 1981, Peter became investigative correspondent for ABC News. He was also a member of the first American crew into Indochina after the end of the Vietnam War. He chased rebel insurgents through Laos and members of the Gambino family through the toxic wastelands of New Jersey. He is our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. He followed the 9/11 attacks. He began investigating the origins of the FBI's original probe of the World Trade Center bomber, Ramzi Ahmed Yusuf. He's our guest now on Coast to Coast. Hey, Peter, welcome back. How are
you? Good to be back, George.
Hey, what do you think of network news nowadays? Has it changed drastically from your days?
Drastically. I think, first of all, forgetting the nightly newscast, the news magazines, when I was on 2020, you had Dateline, of course, 60 Minutes being the paradigm, and on every week there would be at least one solid investigative report. What happened was, over time, both corporations and government officials who were embarrassed by this kind of enterprise reporting began really putting the pressure on network news management. And it became more and more difficult. You know, every story I would do, I would spend as much time defending the story afterwards as I would doing it. So what you then had was the scandal with NBC involving the exploding gas tanks and the pickup trucks. And there was almost a sea change, George. Within about a year of that, they started shifting to this true crime stuff. And if you look at the news magazines now, at least certainly Dateline and Prime Time, and to a lesser degree, 60 Minutes, they tend to do much softer pieces in the guise of investigative pieces, but they really don't have the impact. So that's where I see the true change. And I think also it's clear that the nightly newscasts have gotten lighter, folksier. You know, the fact that, you know, I love Katie Couric in the morning, but the fact that Katie Couric is now going to anchor the CBS Evening News is quite astonishing.
It is dramatic. And of course, with what cable has been doing over the past several years, highlighted of course when Ted Turner broke the way with CNN, that's got to be chipping away at things. I would have predicted that probably within the next 5 years, network newscasts would probably all shift to the cable with some kind of merging, and the networks will be relegated primarily to information and comedy and events like that.
No, it's quite possible. And already, you know, they all have NBC, you know, has MS and CNBC, and they all have some kind of a heavy web presence as it is, as well as a cable presence. So, you know, it's very possible. You know, I was privileged, George, to work for the last great halcyon days of network news, where they actually spent money. I had an investigative unit on Peter Jennings' program, World News Tonight, with two or three people working with me. We could take 6 weeks on a story, if necessary, travel anywhere in the world. I mean, that's just unheard of today.
That's true. How do you like writing now? And, of course, you're a screenwriter and novelist as well. How do you like writing as opposed to strictly doing television?
Well, it's more tedious in the sense that it's much more detail oriented, and when you do books like I do, where you're being critical of the FBI and the Justice Department, it has to be bulletproof. So I have, for example, 1,000 footnotes in my first book. I had 800 in my second book. The new book that I'm doing, Triple Cross, will probably have 1,000 footnotes or endnotes. However, I am hopefully going to be doing a 2-hour documentary for the National Geographic Channel on Triple Cross. The producers that did Inside 9/11, their 4-hour miniseries, and I are collaborating on that. And, you know, we've had a couple of bumps in the road, but hopefully it's going to work out, and it will air on the same right around the time the book comes out, the fifth anniversary. And I've already started, you know, my on-camera work, and it's kind of good to be back in the saddle again, you know, doing that.
Do you remember how to do it?
I think
it's like
I'm,
a bicycle, isn't it?
You know something, George? I don't think I was ready for it when I did it. I was a field producer behind the scenes on 2020, and I had won a couple of Emmys, and I got an offer to go to work at 60 Minutes, and my boss at the time was the legendary Ov Weston.
Oh, sure. Giant. Yep.
Giant, who taught me the concept of signposting, which is always, no matter what you do in the course of a story, always remind the viewer. Now, remember that guy we told you about over here 5 minutes ago?
Yeah.
He's back. Well, anyway, so Ov, I said to my boss, I said, Ov, look, give me a shot. Let me try one on camera. If I screw up, we'll slam Tom Jarrell into it, you know? So he gave me a chance, and he said, if you get a good story. So it was a Friday night in the summer, and I get this call about an unnecessary surgery in a hospital in the Deep South. This pathologist was seeing all kinds of normal tissue. It alleged that a surgeon was, you know, cutting on women without, you know, that were unnecessary surgery, not medical necessity.
Was he doing it for money or was he a wacko?
Well, it was alleged, and I'm about to get to the libel trial in a minute, which we won, but it was alleged that he was doing it. These were Medicaid and Medicare patients. But there was never a proof of a profit motive. It was just that the peer review system in this hospital had broken down, George, and we proved that. And the Joint Commission, after our piece went in and verified what we found. But what happened was, so we did the piece. I won an Emmy. I got sued for $52 million for libel, and so we had a 2-week trial in the Ozark Mountains. And we had this really great attorney. The Chubb Group had the errors and omissions insurance for ABC. And they hired a Buddy Sutton, who was the dean of the law school in Little Rock, who was the classiest lawyer I've ever met in my life. And he was just a brilliant man. So we were right. You know, truth is an absolute defense. When you do investigative reporting, you always run the risk of a libel suit because you're potentially injuring the reputation of another. But if you can prove it's truthful, that you win. So after I won that case, I got a call from the legendary Rune Arledge, you know, the boss who was, you know, when he took over ABC, he'd created sports on television.
Oh, yeah, he came in and he was so good at sports, they kept him as not only the president of sports for a while, but he stayed the president of the ABC News Network.
Yeah, in fact, many people predicted when he came in, because he was a flamboyant character, he wore safari jackets and, you know, pocket handkerchiefs and, you know, smoked Churchill cigar. Everybody was saying, oh, he's going to totally destroy news. Well, he made ABC's. He built their news division. And so anyway, but Rune was notorious. There was a red phone in every control room called the Rune phone. And he would call 24 hours. I'm telling you, George, I once said, I wrote an article after he died for the LA Times, and I said it was the equivalent of Harry Warner giving notes to every writer on the Warner's lot 24 hours a day.
You never slept.
You never slept. So I do my piece. I mean, we win the case, right? We're really ebullient at the time. We're just celebrating. And the phone in the hotel room, and this chill goes up my spine, and they hand it to me, and they go, it's Rune. And I get out, and he goes, Peter, congratulations. I want you to know something. I said, what, Mr. Arledge? He said, if you had lost this case, your next job in broadcasting would have been at the window at Burger King. And he hung up. Oh, God. That was just he was the greatest, so. Anyway.
And you know what? He was serious. He would have done that to you.
And, you know, and it should have happened because, George, this is such an important thing that we do. We have such a responsibility. And when we get into talking tonight about the case involving this former supervisory special agent who is accused now, he's innocent until proven guilty. But I did a major piece on him in cover-up, and now, as we're about to discuss, the Brooklyn DA has indicted him for 4 counts of homicide. It is such an important responsibility for us to be meticulous and bulletproof because we are dealing with people's reputations.
Absolutely. And, Peter, before we get into this, too, I've got to get your reaction to these events that are happening worldwide now, especially now with just a few days ago, Tony Blair finally decided to cut ranks from George Bush, mm-hmm. and he said, you are not going to get any military help in Iran. And I found that to be very interesting because you have to read under the old lines. You got to look at the picture, the big picture.
Right.
And there's something strange afoot here, yet so many people in the markets continue to react as if we're going to go into Iran, take them out by ourselves. Maybe the Israelis are, but I want to get your take on it.
Well, I think it's extraordinarily dangerous. I think that, as you've heard me say this before, George, I think the first night you had me on, which would have been in the fall of 04,
mm-hmm.
I actually, and this was what, a year and how long after the invasion of Iraq, and I was openly critical of it. I said it was going to be a disaster because we were uniting these disparate radical elements who would have killed each other prior to the invasion. You know, the Sunnis behind al-Qaeda would have slit the throats of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party members. They hated each other because
sure.
they were secular Islamists. Well, anyway, by us being there, we have united them into this insurgency. And we've set back the clock in the war on terror years, in my opinion, and created a much greater risk for our country. And we have innocent men and women, good Americans, dying every day, and we have innocent Iraqis, and just the word on the Arab street about America is disastrous. So therefore, when you get a country like Iran that is clearly their goal, so, I mean, to eliminate the state of Israel, it's just such an outrageous goal, and yet, by putting democracy in, by instituting democracy in Iraq, we have put in a pro-Shiite majority that's going to be lockstep with Iran. We've created that alliance, George. But if we had never gone in, and if Saddam had remained, he would have been obviously an awful tyrant and a monster to his own people. But in terms of the strategic imbalance to the area now that has been created in the pursuit of a noble goal, democracy, the instability is extraordinary. So I'm quite concerned. And I think Tony Blair has, you know, it's amazing that it took this long for him to come around.
And a little late, I would say.
Very late. And, you know, it's just, I just pray it's saber rattling. And
Well, here's the problem, though, Peter. I mean, there's no question the head of Iran, Ahmadinejad, is nuts. I mean, unless this guy has been given, you know, let's look at it two ways, all right?
Yeah,
one,
right.
Here's the conspiratorial end. Okay. The Illuminati tells this guy, say anything you want, get the world in an uproar, mm-hmm. just go ahead and do it, don't worry about yourself, we'll protect you. So there's that bizarre possibility, and it is a possibility.
Okay, I'm open
okay.
to, go ahead.
Or he's a wacko, there is that possibility, except I don't see the mullahs shutting him down. And then thirdly, he's speaking at the behest of the mullahs in Iran, and the guy's dead serious, and he wants to get a nuclear weapon, and he wants to use it against Israel. It's one of these three possibilities, isn't it?
And there's a fourth possibility, I think, and that is that it gives him such incredible political capital. It makes Iran such an important power in the region overnight. I mean, they've had a huge standing army, but they suddenly overnight become a world power. And on the basis of their description of fissionable material being produced and some guys holding up these canisters of alleged, you know, weapons grade, you know, material the other day at that ceremony they had with doves in the background, ironically, you know, it's just suddenly he becomes a world power overnight. And you know, he could be taunting the United States and calling our bluff, assuming that the United States doesn't have the chops right now to go in and do this kind of a military action. I mean, you don't have to be in the CIA to understand how overdrawn we are with respect to Iraq militarily. And once the nuclear option is taken, once nuclear and the idea of, you know, Seymour Hersh's report, the idea that there's actually a nuclear option being considered by the United States, once that happens, how far are we away from a nuke being smuggled into a container in the port of Long Beach? I mean, it could happen.
Or through the Bahamas now that the Chinese company of Hutchison Wong Power is going to take over.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the point being, this level of rhetoric just has escalated to such an extraordinary degree. And you know, George, let's just look at the metaphor of the barroom brawl. You know, one guy pushes another guy, and that guy has a friend who hits another guy over the head with a bottle, and then it goes into the street, and knives come out, and then guns come out, and people end up dead. And that's what happens with rhetoric and bulliness.
Yes.
And, you know, machismo. And only we're talking about nuclear war or even conventional war with weapons of mass destruction. And the more people that die from if we invade there or use big bombs over there, you know, the bunker busters, and we kill thousands of civilians. It just is another propaganda victory for the Islamic radicals.
Of course, and it'll be all over television. It's going to be all over Al Jazeera. You can't get away with it. But it's a catch-22, Peter. I mean, what do you do if they indeed do get eventually, and they will if nothing is done, nuclear weapons, and you have them in the hands of people like that?
Well, I think the world community, the world community has to get outraged. The world community has to isolate them. They have to, I mean, look, if the only options we have, and I think, unfortunately, the Bush administration believes this, which is why John Bolton went to the UN kind of with an agenda of the UN is unnecessary. You know, if the only option is a military option, there's no reason to have diplomacy. We've given up. We might as well fold the tent and declare another world war. We have to have options where countries use strong economic power. And that means a lot of these European countries that for years have been arming and, you know, supplying some of these Islamic radical countries with major weaponry. And, you know, the French tried to bring nuclear weapons into Libya in the 80s, you know. And so it's going to take outrage by the world community, but people, they have to unite on this, or else somebody's going to pull the trigger on something, and it's going to then be the point of no return.
Well, I think so. 75 mullahs running Iran, one crazed president. They're all worth, I don't know about the president, but the mullahs are all worth billions because they've siphoned off enough oil money, and they've also paid a few military commanders to keep the troops from throwing them out in some kind of coup.
Right.
But why don't we concentrate on just getting those guys out?
Yeah, well, again, that's 75 mullahs. You know, I mean, where are they? How do you? You see, I think the problem now is a friend of mine, a great man named Harry Allen, who died about a year and a half ago, who knew more about Islam than any born Christian that I ever knew. He converted to Islam, and he had gone into Palestine, and he was of Jewish heritage, by the way. Russian Jewish grandfather, but he went into Palestine to try and help the people in the camps, and he actually arranged for a ceasefire among some of these terror groups for about 2 years, and the FBI Squad 5 in Phoenix was using him for some intelligence, but Harry was a great man, and his theory on how to do this was to take the top 7 or 8 mullahs of the popes of Islam, if you will, and to go in and have them agree that to have a fatwa that basically said that it's okay to do military actions against the military, but you could not do a military action against a civilian population. That would have ruled out 9/11. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And his thought was, instead of taking this thing, because the mullahs are so powerful, instead of trying to win this thing militarily, where every time you kill somebody, it's like Vietnam, you clean out a house in one of these small towns, and the next day the house is full again. You know, it's impossible to root it out. But what if the mullahs declared, could be convinced, and declared some kind of, you know, a world religious conference was convened, and all the great religions of the world, the Pope, Archbishop of Canterbury, the Byzantine Archbishop, you know, the heads of all the great religions, the Dalai Lama, and basically shame these guys, in the name of God, whatever, you know, in the name of Allah, shame them into putting out a fatwa that would make it illegal, in fact, punishable by death, if you attacked civilians, okay? Because there's nothing in the Quran that justifies the taking of innocent human life, okay? There are chapters and verses that can be interpreted for the military. That was Harry's approach to this, and I thought it was brilliantly efficient if something like that could be done. But again, it's a non-military diplomatic
solution. Sure, yeah, but that's also in a perfect world, Peter. Stay with us. When we come back, let's talk cover-up on Coast to Coast AM. Our guest is Peter Lance, and I'm George Norrie. Hey, pick up the After Dark newsletter. You get 14 issues for the price of 12 by calling 1-888-727-5505 or going online at coasttocoastam.com. The April issue, by the way, has an interview with Alex Jones. That's Peter Lance's old sparring partner in former shows. But pick that up, and you'll also get the May edition as well. After Dark, 14 issues for the price of 12. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest this hour and for the rest of the show, Peter Lance. Peter, for I think a lot of us to get a perspective of the of where we're going with your investigation, would you explain to us Able Danger?
Yeah. What happened was in the, and this is from directly from Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, a Bronze Star winner who was one of the coordinators of this project. Sometime in the fall of 1999, this is would have been a year after the African Embassy bombing in August of 88, which is clearly a bin Laden al-Qaeda operation of 234 killed, 5,000 injured. The head of SOCOM, General Pete Schumacher, got together with General Hugh Shelton, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and basically said that we've got to figure out who this group al-Qaeda is, because we're going to be on the ground with our boots on the ground fighting them eventually. So we want to see if we can do an intelligence operation through the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is one of the big five, to try and figure out who they are, identify them, and essentially take them out. Okay? So below the level of bin Laden. So what happened was they went to Fort Belvoir, Virginia, to an elite research entity called LIWA, the Land Information Warfare Activity, LIWA. They actually have a building that's supposedly patterned in some way after the bridge and the Starship Enterprise. These are like the uber geeks of military intelligence, mm-hmm. George, okay?
Okay.
So what they have, what they did was they began a process called data mining. And data mining is when you take both open source and classified information and run it through search bots and basically mine the internet 24 hours a day, everywhere in the world, every language, et cetera, and you begin to look for patterns. And, for example, they would, let's say they put in the Blind Sheikh, the name Blind Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, okay? They would then find everything they could that was open source connected to him. For example, a phone bill from his mosque in Jersey City from 1993. Then they would look at everyone on that phone bill that he called, and they would put them into the mix. And eventually, with these supercomputers, what you got was this massive kind of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon worldwide, okay? and in fact, George, it generated in several months 2.5 terabytes of data equal to a quarter of the books in the Library of Congress. That's how quickly this thing happened. Now, naturally, when you do that, you get 99.999% of the people are innocent, because
yes.
You might get, for example, the guy who owns the cell phone store downstairs from the Sheikh's mosque, right? He's not a terrorist, but you might pick him up in the suite.
Sure.
So, anyway, but then what they do is they go and they refine those. They have super search connection programs, and then they have a thing called Analyst Notebook, a high-end graphic representation program that allows them to do what they call link charts. And basically what they found, what Able Danger found, according to Tony Schaefer and others connected to the unit, in the year fairly early in the year 2000, they found direct connection between active al-Qaeda cells who were then obviously working on the 9/11 plot. They had direct connections between them and the Brooklyn cell of Blind Sheikh Rahman. They found direct al-Qaeda presence in Aden, Yemen, the port of Aden. They found, they identified Mohammed Atta, who became the lead hijacker, and two of the other hijackers, Al-Madar and Al-Hazmi, okay? Two of the muscle hijackers,
yeah.
Okay? Now, this is in by their account in the year 2000, early. At some point, and this is what the mystery is, no one, and it's still no one knows the truth, even when they had a hearing recently, February 15th in the House, which was kind of a dog and pony show, what is unknown is an order came out to destroy this data. There's a certain presidential directive that was signed by President Reagan that says that you're not supposed to keep data on U.S. persons, and that's a legal term of art that defines not just civilians but corporations, etc., for more than 90 days. But there are so many exceptions to it, George, including a huge one for terrorism, that there was no reason, that was the ostensible reason given for the destruction of the data. And supposedly much of this data was destroyed. And this happened on Clinton's watch, okay?
All right.
So now, Anthony Schaefer is supposed to have, Lieutenant Colonel Schaefer is supposed to have three meetings during the course of 2000 with the FBI to try and share this information. And this is another one of the unknown factors. The meetings were all canceled, and no one can say for sure, it hasn't been identified, whether the FBI initiated the cancellation or the DOD, the Department of Defense. But in any event, here's the irony, George. One of the meetings was to take place in September of 2000. And remember, I told you that he had information that there was an active Al-Qaeda connection to the Blind Sheikh and an active Al-Qaeda connection to Aden, Yemen. Okay?
Sure.
2 weeks later, approximately 2 weeks, bin Laden has his infamous video fatwa where he was wearing the Yemeni dagger. And in that fatwa, he has the son of Blind Sheikh Rahman, who was jailed in 1993, 7 years earlier. And he has that son say, go to the spilling of blood for your sheikh and remember El-Sayed Nasser, who you know very well from our many times here, was the guy who killed Rabbi Kahane.
Mm-hmm.
That goes back to 1989, okay? The killing was in 90, but the FBI had him on their radar in 1989. So that video fatwa alone, George, was an advertisement that basically said both attacks on the World Trade Center are connected. This is an Al-Qaeda operation dating back to 1989. That's the message bin Laden was sending. What happens 2 weeks later? The coal bombing in Aden, Yemen. And the captain of that ship later told investigators connected to Congressman Kurt Weldon, who has courageously been trying to get to the truth on this, the captain of that Navy ship said if he had had that intelligence, he would have done the refueling offshore. He wouldn't have come into port. And 17 U.S. servicemen would be alive today. Okay?
I'm with
so
you.
That's the consequence of ignoring this Able Danger information. And the reason I got into this and the reason both Tony Schaefer Tart has spoken so much to me and Colonel Congressman Weldon is that in both of my books, I had, if you remember, a link chart. And the link chart was identical to the Able Danger link charts. In fact, it was done by Jacob L. Boson, who was a contract hire for the Defense Intelligence Analysis Center at Bowling Air Force Base. And that chart, the one I have in both books, comes from August of 99, just a few months before Able Danger. And that chart shows a direct connection between the Blind Sheikh and Ramzi Youssef and Al-Qaeda. So what happened, the ultimate sad part about this in terms of the cover-up was that Tony, you have to cut forward now to the fall of 03. And Tony is now in Afghanistan, and he's hunting bin Laden with an elite unit, a task force over there. And he gets the word comes out that Philip Zelikow, the head of the 9/11 Commission, is going to be there in Bagram, and he's interested in anyone that might have some prior knowledge of, you know, on the road to 9/11, intelligence. So Tony gets permission from his general and goes and briefs Philip Zelikow and tells him this whole story that I just told you. And according to Tony, Zelikow is really, like, shocked and literally wakes people up at what would have been 4 in the morning in the East and said, let's get into this. Gives Tony his card, tells Tony, as soon as you get back stateside, which would have been early 04, we want to talk to you, okay? Because
sure.
We're the 9/11 Commission. So Tony gets back. He calls the commission in January. He gets kind of blown off. 2 weeks later, he calls them again, and they basically tell him, we don't really need this information anymore. We've got what we need. Well, as it turns out, they didn't even get the information for weeks later. And all they got were a couple of briefcases of data versus the 2.5 terabytes. And so Tony, all of a sudden then, George, mysteriously, who has some of these link charts in his office, finds out that his security clearance has been revoked. He's set up on trumped-up charges like a $67 cell phone bill. They allege he misused $180 in mileage charge to a court when he's commuting to Fort Dix. I mean, ridiculous stuff. He loses his security clearance, this guy who's a Bronze Star winner and a real hero. And by the way, Tony Schaefer is both J2 and J3. He's both intelligence and operations. He's a rare breed. And so he suddenly is shut out. He finds out they've cleaned out his office. There's no evidence anymore of Able Danger. And there's some kind of cover-up going on by this, the Bush 43 Defense Department. Why? This apparently is a scandal that happened on Clinton's watch. Nobody can understand this. Well, the bottom line is that when another operative in order to corroborate Tony so that he wasn't hung out to dry, Scott Philpott, a Navy captain who was also involved, went to testify before the 9/11 Commission mid-June of 2004. Now, remember, the commission's report was going to come out about a month later. So they're in the final throes of doing their report.
They probably already had it printed up, to tell you the truth, Peter.
George, they already had the scenario long before, in the early days of meeting, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And, okay, but anyway, and Democrats and Republicans, by the way. Okay, so anyway, he corroborates Tony, and who does he talk to? The man whose name will reverberate tonight when we talk about DeVecchio and the Scarpa Jr. is Dieter Snell. And Dieter Snell, who now is Deputy Attorney General in New York, who works for Elliot Spitzer, Dieter Snell was the assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District who prosecuted Ramzi Youssef, the original Trade Center bomber, for the second case he was tried on, which is called the Bojinka case, the Manila Air case.
Mm-hmm.
He then went on to become the, he should have been a witness before the 9/11 Commission for reasons that I can get into. He should have been called as a witness because he participated, in my opinion, in several cover-ups in the Southern District. But they, instead, they make him senior counsel to the Commission, and they charge him and his staff with the origin of the plot. Now, the origin of the 9/11 plot is equal to the question of whether Oswald acted alone to the Warren Commission.
Sure.
It's the essential question because, why? Because, George, if you can't tell when it started, you can't hold our agencies accountable for not stopping it, right?
That's right.
And what he did, what Dietrich Snell did, was basically he pushed forward the origin of the plot from 94 in Manila, where Ramzi Youssef began the plot, and he pushed it forward to 2 years to Afghanistan and claimed that Khalid Sheikh, Ramzi's uncle, was who wasn't even in al-Qaeda at the time, kind of pitched the idea to bin Laden offhandedly, and that's when the plot began.
And this Khalid Sheikh, by the way, Peter,
yeah.
He's the one that is supposed to be in captivity,
right,
spilling his guts out. And I find this strange that if that's true, he'd have, I mean, apparently this guy's got so much information because everything that leaks out about a possible terrorist attempt is based on what he's told them, but they seem to be releasing it in little tiny stages. I mean, he's been held now for 2 years,
he's
hasn't he?
He's been held since March of 2003. It was reported that he was on Diego
3 years.
Garcia. But here's what's important, George. In the 9/11, and you're absolutely right, by the way, what you just said, the report on the attack in L.A., remember that recently,
yep,
recently, a few months ago? Well, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, by the way, who's, by many accounts, has been waterboarded and tortured, and torture means he's an unreliable witness. And second of all, even if he hadn't been tortured, he's a senior operative in al-Qaeda, so what he says it has to be taken with a grain of salt because he has every interest in lying, right, and covering
right
up the truth. So Khalid Sheikh Mohammed turns out to be the sole authority for Dietrich Snell and the 9/11 Commission reaching this conclusion about the origin of the plot. In other words, when you go to the 9/11 report and you look at that conclusion that the plot was pitched to bin Laden by this guy who wasn't even in al-Qaeda, which is totally a lie. It's a bold-faced lie, okay? In my book, A Thousand Years for Revenge proves that the plot was hatched in Manila, and I have massive documentary evidence from the Philippines National Police, not only that it was hatched in Manila by Youssef, but that it was financed by bin Laden through his brother-in-law, Muhammad Jamal Khalifa. I mean, I have it in spades, and I've never been challenged in that book, A Thousand Years for Revenge, on any significant fact whatsoever by the Bureau, never challenged since 2003. And here, the most important question to be answered by the last official body to look into the biggest mass murder in American history, and they take the word of Khalid Sheikh. Now, elsewhere in that report, in the footnotes, they mention Khalid Sheikh, and they go and they use that famous Churchill phrase, a bodyguard of lies. They say he's unreliable, and his stuff is surrounded by a bodyguard of lies. Later, Dietrich Snell did an interview for that same production company, Towers Productions, when they did Inside 9/11, and I found a quote from that. It's on their website, in fact. If you go to the Nat Geo Channel website and look up Dietrich Snell, he actually talks about how Ramzi bin al-Shib, who was the assistant to Khalid Sheikh, and Khalid had lied openly to Yassi Fudra from Al Jazeera, and he said he's unreliable. So if he's unreliable, then why are you using him, Dietrich, as the sole authority for the origin of the plot?
Well, here's the other thing I can't understand. And again, as events start to unfold and they talk about terror attempts,
yeah,
you know, watch out for stadiums, mm-hmm, you know, some of the stuff they attribute is attributed to this guy. And I'm sitting back saying, after 3 years of captivity, this guy's still singing the blues. He's giving them information. Is he doing it in little pieces? It
right
doesn't make any sense. If you're
right
going to talk,
right,
you say it all real fast.
Right.
It's not pulled out over 3 years, is it?
Well, I'm not an expert on either interrogation or torture, but I would believe that when a person is subjected to those kind of harsh interrogation techniques, they shoot their load pretty rapidly. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In other words, the question also is, and I think all Americans should ask this question, why hasn't Khalid Sheikh Mohammed been charged? I mean, he is now, since June of 2002.
And we don't know where he is, really.
Not only do we not know where he is, but he's never been, that we know of, he's never been charged. So he's called the mastermind of 9/11. The Justice Department and the FBI identify him. The only person that's been charged is Zacharias Moussaoui, and that we know of, unless there are secret sealed indictments that we don't know about.
Right.
And why not? And here's the answer to why he's never been charged, in my opinion. It's the same answer as to why Ali Mohammed, the subject of my new book, who was al-Qaeda's chief spy for years, who infiltrated the FBI, the CIA, and the Green Berets, why he has never been sentenced. And the answer is, they don't want these guys to tell their stories in open court where defense counsel can peel them back and expose the multiple acts of negligence by the FBI and the Justice Department on the road to 9/11. It's called CYA embarrassment. And yet, George, if this was the Department of Agriculture and you were covering up acts of negligence and not sharing information with other agencies, it wouldn't be so catastrophic. But we're talking about national security. And the absolute, and I've documented dozens of examples of this on the road to 9/11, the fact that the U.S. Justice Department's two bin Laden offices of origin, the best of the best, New York City, the FBI's New York office, NYO, and the SDNY, the Southern District Office, all of the war on terror until 9/11 was fought as a series of legal cases in these offices. Sum total of all the knowledge in the Justice Department exists on al-Qaeda exists in these offices. Okay? And yet, they screwed up so many times, and they covered up information that could have interdicted the 9/11 plot multiple occasions. And this DeVecchio case, when we get to it, believe it or not, who would believe when you said, I'm going to tell you a story about how al-Qaeda met the mob? I mean, who would believe that?
Yeah.
But the truth is, it's true, and that case alone, if they follow it through to the end, could reopen the 9/11 investigation.
Do you believe that in this particular case, this cover-up adds to the credence of the conspiracy theorists who believe that there was either an inside job or there was some help or somebody turned their cheek?
I think it... See, the thing is, you said three separate things there. And and you know what I've always done, and this is why Alex and I got into the sparring match, you know? What I've always done, George, is I say some very, very strong things, and I'll be happy to name names tonight, and because truth is an absolute defense. But I don't like to jump to the next level where I might speculate. You know, I clearly...
So you would be in that mode if you jumped ahead then. You'd be speculating.
Like, here's what I found. I've absolutely found evidence of criminal negligence, gross negligence that bordering on criminal, and in fact, Harry Samet, who testified at the Moussaoui trial, the FBI agent from Minneapolis, actually used that term. He said there was criminal negligence by the Radical Fundamentalist Unit, and David I don't know if he actually associated David Frasca himself with the criminal negligence.
Well, but you can't prove intent, though, can you?
I cannot prove that they... I believe I can prove that they, when I say they, that senior FBI agents and Justice Department officials intentionally obscured and covered up information. But I can't impugn a motive to them for that.
Yeah.
I can't jump to the next level.
Okay, well then if you did, you'd be in the conspiracy pot.
And you know something... If I find it, I'll walk through that door, George, but I can't walk through it if I don't have it.
I understand. Well, when we come back, Peter, let's talk about this case at hand that you're talking about, this relationship between bin Laden, al-Qaeda, and the mob. I'll be back.